What's up, guys? You're listening to Geek Talk. Today we're going to hear from Aseem Kishore. Aseem is going to introduce us to Neo4j, the most popular graph database, and he's going to share some experience and lessons he's learned from building a startup on top of it. For more stuff like this, you can check us out at g33ktalk.com.
Well, as Peter said, my name is Aseem Kishore. I'm a developer at a startup here in New York called 53. We make an iPad app called Paper. Just a quick show of hands, how many people have heard of Paper or 53? Okay, so we have some work to do. as a company, 53 is a space to create. We're trying to build tools to help people create on mobile devices, you know, in like the post-PC era. So our first product is an iPad app called Paper. We launched it about a year ago. Actually, just over a year ago. It's an iPad app that lets you have digital journals that you can, you know, freeform sketch and write and draw in. So that doesn't sound like something that you'd need a graph database for. So I can't share exactly what we're working on with this today, but, you know, stay tuned. It's forthcoming. But before 53, I co-founded a startup with a friend called The Thingdom. And this was a social network around products, so you could imagine, like, you know, some of the cliches are it's a Yelp for products or like Amazon meets Facebook. So it's, trying to be very personalized, trying to bring your social graph into the product review kind of space. So this screenshot, for example, shows my co-founder. He was really big into photography. So, you know, he collected a lot of photography gear, cameras, lenses, that sort of stuff. So this was a site that let him kind of show the stuff that he had and the stuff that he wanted. So when we started The Thingdom, neither my co-founder and I had any experience with the graph database. We didn't even know there was such a thing as a graph database. But it got worse. We didn't actually have any experience with even relational databases. We toyed with MySQL here and there, but nothing really serious. What we did have was experience with a site we'd built while we were at Microsoft working on some image streaming technology for the web. This site was called Zoomit. The color on the projectors, by the way, is a little dark, so just let me know if you can't quite make out anything. I mean, it doesn't matter for this slide, but for the future. So Zoomit was kind of like a Bitly for high-res images. The idea was that you put in a URL to any image on the web, doesn't matter how high-resolution it was. You could paste in NASA images that were gigapixels or whatnot, huge panoramas. And in the cloud, we'd kind of convert that image to a streamable format and then give you back a short URL and an embeddable viewer. So for that, very much like Bitly, there isn't really any relational data at play, so we used a key value store. We were at Microsoft at the time, so we used Windows Azure, and it has something kind of similar to Amazon SimpleDB, if you guys are familiar with that, like a very highly partitionable key value store, high performance, that sort of stuff. So we had experience with that. So when we started The Thingdom, that was kind of our starting point. And of course, even today, kind of the hot kids on the block in the database world are stuff like MongoDB and Redis and maybe Couch. And these are all, I don't know if key value store is the right term precisely for them, but they're all meant for very high performance, highly partitionable data. So we thought we'd kind of start there. But then very quickly, we realized that if you're building a social graph on top of this, how do you performantly get any arbitrary person's friends and their products that they have or want and tie it back to you? And so we thought, do you make multiple requests for that? Is that something that a database can do efficiently? So we thought this surely must be a solved problem. Actually, at the time that we were starting this, Facebook had just launched their Open Graph API. So we thought they must know something. So we did a bunch of, we did what hopefully any developers would do in that kind of scenario. We Googled it and we did a lot of research. And we found that although there were some resources for how to use a relational database or key value store to do graphs, there was actually this field of graph databases that people were working on. And it felt like, relatively new, but we ended up settling on one such graph database, which seemed like the most versatile and usable out of the box. And it's ended up being kind of one of the most mainstream ones, which is good. It's called Neo4j. So this is a screenshot of the administrative panel, you could say, that comes out of the box in Neo4j, which is really, I mean, this kind of, in a screenshot, I love the screenshot because it shows kind of the utility and usability of Neo4j. It's really nice. This shows a snapshot of our Thingdom data are related to me at some point in time, which is pretty cool. So in the center is my node, and you can see all the different types of relationships that other nodes in the database are connected to me with. So, for example, I am the author of some things here, which are comments. I follow 209 people there, and so on and so forth. So I'll get more into this, but real quick, I just want to talk about why we settled on graph databases in general and Neo4j in specific. So the biggest reason is because it let us translate what we would draw on the whiteboard, like this, directly to the database. So we didn't have to, think about how we translate what we conceptually think of our data as our domain as to, like, what is this, what is the table design? How do we break this out into tables versus columns versus rows? What stuff do we need to denormalize versus normalize? Which things are our primary keys? Which things do we index? Obviously, a lot of that stuff still matters as you want to build a really high-performance, high-scale app. You want to understand the implementation. But it was really nice because in Neo4j, what you draw on the whiteboard, this is actually what gets persisted in a graph database. You literally have nodes and edges. So what this drawing, pardon the poor handwriting, what this drawing shows is that we have three users here on the left, Alice, Bob, and Carol. They have some follows relationships between each other. And then we have a product here, this iPhone, and it shows that Alice has an iPhone, Bob wants an iPhone, and it shows that Bob is the author of this comment here, whose message is thoughts, and this comment is, on the iPhone. Carol wrote another comment that says she loves it, so on and so forth. So that was really cool. That let us work very rapidly. That let us prototype very rapidly and iterate very rapidly. So that was nice. Another great aspect about it was that it let us build features without... it let us, especially when we evolved early on, it let us tweak the data and change things and make use of the data in useful ways very quickly. So here's a screenshot of a recommendation engine. I use that term very loosely, by the way. This isn't anything complicated. It's just literally a page on our website we made where we could show you people that you're not following today that you might want to follow. And the simplest metric we used for that was friend of friends, second degree connections. So these are people that you follow. And so not that would necessarily be hard to do, whatever database you use, but the cool thing was it was very easy to conceptualize because literally the way you think about it is fetch my friends, fetch their friends, and then rank them in order of how many of the first level of friends that I have. And in this case, we were able to show you not only just the number, but specifically, like when you hovered over two people here, we showed you the specific friends of yours that followed those, that person. So in this case, what that looked like as a query, I'll get to this more later, but Neo4j has a query language called Cypher, which is kind of modeled off SQL, kind of modeled off this other graph query language called Sparkle. But basically, you give it a start point. So in this case, you have two users, and you want to find their common friends. Actually, I'm sorry. I made one quick mistake. Well, the query I'm about to show you is not for this. It's for something different. So this was a simple example of recommendation engine. Another feature that we started building was a recommendation engine for products. So if I want an iPhone 5, show me the friends I have that have an iPhone 5. So now I know who to ask for reviews, who to ask to physically borrow it from, try things out. It could be used if you're in college, you live in a dorm, you want to share things like a vacuum cleaner or whatnot, right? So that's something where conceptually the way we think about it is literally show me the things I have that another person wants or vice versa. And so we were able to translate that to a query really simply. So in Neo4j's query language, it's literally ASCII art. You draw one node here, this user node, and another user node there. You draw the thing in the middle and an arrow going this way, an arrow going that way, and then you say where the two relationship types are not the same. So if this one is has, this one should be wants, and vice versa. And you return all three things, and that gets you exactly what you want. Here are the first relationship types, here are the second relationship types, and here's the thing. And so the cool thing was, to do this query, we didn't have to at all rethink our database schema or our table design or anything like that. The data was already in the graph, and we could query that not only easily but also efficiently. because these are the kind of queries that graph databases are great at. But the last reason actually is just it was just a lot of fun, and I think you can't underestimate the value of that when you're a developer. So at 53, for example, and you know, we take this very seriously. At 53, we have a company culture of craftsmanship, and so I personally think there's a lot to be said for you should really love your tools. You should really enjoy working with your tools, and that's something we came to really love about using Neo4j specifically and graph databases generally. I should pause here and give credit where credit's due. This is my co-founder, Daniel, who's the one who introduced me to Neo4j and kind of forced it down my throat, you could say. But so thanks, Daniel. He's not here physically, but he's here in spirit. All right, so let's talk about just what is a graph database. If you look on Wikipedia for graph database, you'll find this diagram. And this is specifically called a property graph. So we're all familiar with what a graph is generally, but there's a specific type of graph called property graph, which pretty much all graph databases implement specifically. So property graphs are saying that you have nodes and edges, like any graph database, but those nodes and edges can have key value pairs on them. So you don't technically need to model your data as that. You could actually say, every property should be a node in the graph, you could say, but just for simplicity, every graph database I've seen implements property graphs that let you have simple key value pairs on your nodes and relationships. And even more precisely, the only kind of required property you need in a graph database is the type for the relations. So Neo4j specifically is a schemaless graph database. So that means the nodes can have any key value properties you want, same with the relationships, but the relationships have to have types because that's what gives structure to the graph. Because otherwise, if you just have end relationships from any node, the graph database can't really help you optimize for which relationships it should traverse for any given query, which ones it should ignore. So that's just, that's a general property graph. And so how do you represent a graph in code? If you guys remember from your computer science classes, there's two high-level ways. One is called an adjacency list, where for each node in the graph, you maintain a list of all of its neighbors, or relationships, or whatever you want to call it. The other way is an adjacency matrix, where instead of a list of lists, you have a 2D matrix, and each value in the matrix is whether the node X is connected to the node Y. So at a high level, these are the two different approaches you could take for implementing a graph. The trade-off is in space and time. So adjacency lists are better in space performance because you don't have to use up space for maintaining relationships that aren't there or like tracking relationships that aren't there between nodes. Adjacency lists are poorer in terms of time if you want to look up relationships between two specific nodes, right? Because you'll have to traverse a list. They're better in time if you're frequently adding and removing nodes because you don't have to keep on adjusting the matrix. So there's a couple of space-time trade-offs there. Neo4j implements the graph database as an adjacency list, and I can't imagine any graph database would implement it as an adjacency matrix because of those trade-offs, but there might be one out there that I haven't encountered. So I'll just jump real quick into showing Neo4j's implementation specifically because it informs some of how you think about executing queries on against a graph database, things like that. You can ignore the very specific details. These slides are taken from a Neo4j team member's presentation on the very specific low-level internals in Neo4j. I'll just describe it at a high level. So this diagram shows a very simple graph where you have four nodes. They're all people. And you have some nodes relationships between them. So, person A knows person B, so on and so forth. So this is how we might conceptualize that graph. You have these four nodes. They have some properties on them. And here are the relationships. Well, I just said that Neo4j stores these things as adjacency lists. So the first thing is we can take out the properties. So it stores all the properties as lists also. So each node has a pointer to a property. So this is a linked list. Each node has a pointer to its first property, and that property has a pointer to the next properties, and so on and so forth. Right? And each property is a key value pair, like age 27, nationality Swedish, right? Then same thing for the relationships. So each node has a pointer to its head relationship, and each relationship has a pointer to its start and end node, and then each relationship has a pointer to the next relationship for that node. So this very confusing diagram. Don't worry about that. It boils down to this on disk, on the file format. So this is, the text is hard to read, so I'll read it out loud. As with any database, it's all about fixed size records, so you have very fast performance for lookups. So you know, if you know that you want to get the node for user X, if you can translate that X to an ID, then that lookup for that node is extremely fast because that ID is a file offset on disk. So these fixed size records are for the node. You can see that it's just two IDs, its first relationship and its first property. So there's the linked list. It just points to the head of each, right? And then relationships, you know, you have to map the beginning node and the end node. But other than that, it's the same thing. It's first property, and then the next relationship for the start node, the next relationship for the end node. And that's all it is. That's the rabbit hole. It just keeps going and going. So you can see that Neo4j implements the graph database as an adjacency list. That, you know, that informs how you think about this. And we'll get there in a second when we talk about queries. So it's worth pausing at this point just to, you know, just to state up front that with all databases, at a high level, it doesn't matter how you choose to represent that data. As long as you're not losing information, the data will always conceptually be the same. So in fact, any graph you can actually store in a relational database, and I'm sure anyone who's worked with relational database seriously, you've done this, whether you realize it or not. So here's a simple example of a graph where you have this red node connected to these three blue nodes. This is what it looks like as a graph, and here's what it might look like in a relational database, where you have some table of, you know, let's say you want to call this, let's say we're Instagram, and we have users and photos, right? So this this first table is users. Here's our the red row. This red record corresponds to the user we're interested in. These blue records in this table of photos corresponds to the photos for that user. And it's here in this join table, this foreign key table, where we map those relationships from user to photo. So you know, you commonly call that foo underscore bar, for example, right? So it's the same data. It's just how do you represent it. But the thing I love about this diagram, by the way, also came from another Neo4j member. The thing I love about this diagram is it shows very clearly actually what precisely the definition of a graph database is. Whereas in a relational database, these connections are in one big table where you have to find them, so you know, you'll have to index them as a global index. Here, the relationships are local to this node. So if you think about a social graph like Facebook, right? In theory, it shouldn't matter how many people are on Facebook if you just want to find your friends. It should only matter how many friends you have. So if you have if you have 50 friends, it shouldn't matter whether Facebook has a million users or a billion users, right? And so that's what a graph database is all about. And so, you know, obligatory meme here about joins. but that's what it's about. Graph databases save you joins. And so these two quotes are stolen from Wikipedia. It's that a graph database provides index-free adjacency. So that means that any adjacency information you're interested in, that information is available local to the thing you're looking at. You don't have to look up look into a global index to get that information. I'm going to pause here. Does that make sense so far? Anyone have questions on general graph database definitions or theories or anything like that? Yeah. Let me get to all that stuff later. Any questions on just like general like understanding what a graph database is, things like that? Okay, so I'll move on. So let's talk about how you query a graph database given this information. So if you think, you know, let's think of an example like Google Maps. A very typical query for a mapping application is directions. Get me from here to there, right? So the way you do that is you have a start point, and then you're going to traverse the graph until you get to the end point. And so that's for finding a path. But you can follow that same pattern for answering questions like we did earlier about find me my mutual friends or mutual products, things like that, right? You have one or more start points, and you're going to traverse the graph, pruning paths you're not interested in along the way and following paths that you are interested in along the way, ultimately getting information. So you can generalize that pretty simply to start somewhere and traverse elsewhere. And so in Neo4j, how that, you know, what that maps to is the way you can start is either through Neo4j has a concept of a root node. So every graph, they say, has one node at the beginning that you can then build off of if you want. You don't have to do this. Another way that I mentioned early on was using the IDs of the nodes that Neo4j exposes, because those give you very high performance, because those are just, you know, file offsets in the on-disk storage format. But the third way is you could index the nodes yourself. So in fact, you can do this yourself. You can use any index you want. Neo4j has Lucene built in, which is really useful. So you can index, for example, users based on their email address, or login usernames. You can index, in our case, we were indexing Amazon products by their URLs or Amazon IDs, things like that. So anyway, you come up with nodes to start from, and then you follow the graph from those nodes. So Neo4j in particular has a few ways to do this. So one is traversal APIs. We'll talk about specifically how you access those APIs in a sec, but you can give it a precise algorithm for follow these kinds of relationships, ignore these kinds of paths, so on and so forth. You can use cipher patterns like we saw in the beginning, where it's basically ASCII art. You're giving it a declarative pattern to match. You can almost think of it like a regular expression for a graph. You give it a pattern, and it's going to follow paths that fit that pattern. Or even better, Neo4j has some popular graph algorithms built into it. So I mentioned that mapping problem earlier. It has Dijkstra built in. It has A*STAR built in. So that's pretty cool. Okay, so now how do you actually use Neo4j? Neo4j, by the way, it's a pretty ridiculous name. I totally agree if that's what you thought in the beginning. It's using the decade-old meme of X for J, meaning it's for Java. So originally, Neo4j was just a jar file that you'd put into your Java application to have a graph database that you could access. So they still have that. They still have a Java API that you can use. I know a lot of their customers, they say, use that. I can't imagine why exactly you'd want to use that instead of using it as a standalone server so that you could scale your application separately from your database. So that's another way you can do it, which is nice. Funny story, actually. Just before we started the thing, Neo4j wasn't available as a server. Their kind of answer to that question was always, you should write your own server using the jar file so that you can get your domain specific operations as the REST API. But eventually they kind of realized that everybody wants to use it as a server, or a lot of people do. So they now ship Neo4j as a standalone server, and it's actually very robust. It has a good REST API. There's also kind of orthogonal to this. You saw an example of Cypher. There's this query language Cypher that actually can be used through both. So you could think of it as how do I access Neo4j? It's either got to be through the Java APIs or the REST API. But if you want to use a very custom and precise query language, you can do that on both. So now we're at the topic of this, this meetup in particular for how to use Neo4j from Node.js. So when we built Thingdom, in fact, we did use it from Node.js. We used the REST API. When we started, there was no Cypher. Over time, they started prototyping Cypher. It seemed like a killer way to do stuff, so we eventually transitioned all of our code to use Cypher. But we were, just to be precise, we were still using the REST API technically. It's just there's one REST API endpoint for submitting a Cypher query, as opposed to generally working with the graph through the REST API, like CRUD operations and stuff. All right, so when we started, there wasn't actually a formal story for using Neo4j from Node.js. So for example, there was no client library or driver, so we ended up building and open sourcing one. And so this is, I think, a good place to pause and do a little bit of live coding. And then after that, I'll return to this and talk about lessons learned and things like that. All right, so so we have this guy, and I was connected to Wi-Fi just a bit ago. So give me 1 second, please. Okay. So, how about them Yankees? Well, if this doesn't work, we have code offline, so that's okay. Let's just assume this won't work. All right. So we built an open source this driver. It's available on NPM as Neo4j, and it's very similar to what you might have used for other databases from Neo4j, right? It's a driver that lets you create, read, update, delete the things in your database. So the usage is pretty simple. You require it from, well, you know, first you npm install it. Standard node stuff. npm install it, put it in your package JSON, whatnot. Require it, and then what you get back is a graph database class. You point it at your graph database, and now you can do things like create node, and you can set properties on that guy, and then save it, and fetch its relations, follow its path. We have full API documentation and whatnot, but I'll quickly show you what Neo4j looks like as well. So, looks like Wi-Fi's still, oh, there we go, it's back. So, github.com/thingdom/node-neo4j. But this is the Neo4j control panel, you could see, or web admin, they call it. This is almost a fresh install of Neo4j, and you know, if you guys are new to this, neo4j.org/download. Linux, you know, choose your platform, download the latest version, and unzip it, start it up, and it's pretty nice. All you have to do is Neo4j start, and it runs by default on 7.4.7.4, and you have this whole web admin out of the box, which is great. So this lets you explore your data. For example, here's my root node, and I can see, well, it has no properties but or any relationships, but if I wanted to fetch, let's say, a different node, here's some node with, you know, two different relationships on it, and so on and so forth. So this is pretty cool. It also has a console built in for working with Cypher, or and they have a nice shell language that's very similar to Unix. Like, you can cd around and ls and things like that. In fact, I can cd to one. Oh, cd dash a one. And now I can ls to it and see all the relationships from that guy. So, you know, that sort of stuff is nice. So we have this driver. All the API documentation kind of shows, the way you might use it. We have different classes like graph database and node and relationship and things like that. Start the graph database, and you can see the kinds of things you can do. You can create nodes. You can fetch nodes either by the ID or by index values. You can run Cypher queries. Once you have nodes, you know, you can fetch or create relationships. You can follow some of the built-in path algorithms that we mentioned, right, like Dijkstra and A*STAR. But one thing that we built a while back, which is pretty nice, is a sample Node.js app to use this library to kind of show usage. So this is a pretty standard Express app. You can find it at GitHub, acmk, node, neo4j, template, dash in the name, and it's up and running on Heroku. So it's also meant to be easily deployable to Heroku. And in fact, Neo4j is available as an add-on in Heroku, which is pretty nice. You don't use it in production. It's still kind of in alpha/beta. But that makes it really easy to just deploy and start playing with this. And the README has instructions. But I thought I'd just walk through this code just to give an example of how you actually hook up a Neo4j database to an Express Node app. So, whenever you guys want, clone this. If you have your laptops out, break this out. Download Neo4j, get rolling. But so here's an Express 3 app auto-generated, and the only thing that's been added here is some routes. So let me just show you the app running as an example. So this is, you'll have to pardon the UI, it's awful. I take full responsibility. But this is just a very simple sample app for just managing users and the follows relationships between them. No authentication or anything like that. It just lets you create, I'll create a new user, and I'll have it follow me, or I can have it unfollow me, I can change the name, so on and so forth, right? So just a simple example of how a web app might work with Neo4j data. So if you guys have your laptops, feel free to start hammering this thing, node, Neo4j template. And you shouldn't break it, because if you break it, that's a bug. So we'll walk through this app and just show how we implement it real quick. So we'll start most user-facing. What are the different things users can do? Well, they can list all the users. They can create a user. They can show a particular user. They can edit a particular user. And they can delete a user, right? So this is very Rails-like, very typical MVC app kind of CRUD stuff. But in addition, we have the relationships, right? So post to /ID/follow to follow someone. And post to unfollow them. You can get a bit more restful, I agree. So let's look at our routes. So we'll start with just listing users. So assume we have some user model, and then we'll talk about, just like in Rails or something, you might have an active record model to wire it up to MySQL. We'll talk about how we wired up our model to Neo4j. But assuming we have a user model, you know, what are the kind of methods we want to be able to call on it? Well, one is user.getAll. And if you guys are, it seemed like everyone raised their hand for having used Node.js, right? Let me verify that. Just raise your hand if you've used Node.js, period. Okay, so there's some people that haven't. So I'll just state one quick thing out of the way. You know, Node.js, everything is asynchronous, for better or worse. So anytime you want to make a network operation, you supply a callback for what to do when that operation is complete. And there are all sorts of libraries out there that help with that. But for the sake of this example, I wanted to keep it, you know, plain old JavaScript just to show the capabilities. So you want to be able to get all users. And then, you know, that should give you a list of users, right? You want to be able to create a user, give it some information about that user, and then get back the user object. You want to be able to show a user. So user.get, in this case, we're passing by ID. But in addition, we also want to get that user's neighbors, people they follow. And in this case, for the sake of the app, not sure if you caught this, but one thing I can do is I show the people a user, you know, we show the users someone currently follows, but we also show everyone else so that we can then choose to follow them. So if I type, you know, if I follow this user Neo4j Rocks, that's shown here, but the rest of all users is also shown over here. And another caveat, of course, in any real high-scale app, you would never fetch all users because that just doesn't scale. But you know, for the sake of this example, you might fetch all of the person's first-degree friends and their second-degree friends, for example, things like that. So this is a simple example. If you know we want to get a particular user, but for that user, get their first-degree connections and everyone else. You want to be able to edit a user, so the user should be able, you know, you should be able to call save on that user after changing some properties. Obviously, you want to be able to delete a user. And then you want to know, you want to be able to follow, you know, have one user follow another and unfollow. So hopefully that makes sense. We'll jump now to the model. So this is where the meat of the stuff is, right? So usage up here, you can see we require the library. We initialize our graph database client with the URL to the database. So by default and during development, Neo4j runs port 7474. Yeah.
Does it directly support that in the query language?
Yes. Yeah, great question. We'll get there in just a sec. We'll show how we actually implement this stuff, and then we'll talk about how we can adapt it, right? So yeah, in this example, we initialized the graph database client to the default location of a development Neo4j instance. But when we deploy it to the cloud, obviously that's not going to be the case. So we have a hook in here for if the environment has a config set pointing to the Neo4j database, that's what we should use. All right, so here we have a very typical JavaScript class called user, and that's what we export in this for this model. And it actually just encapsulates the node object that the node Neo4j library returns, gives us, right? So you could imagine whatever driver you are using, whether it's Neo4j or MySQL or any other database, that driver will probably give you back some object instead of raw strings. So we'll just encapsulate that object and do everything with that. So one is that if the web app asks for, maybe I should say if the controller in our web app asks for the user's ID, we'll just return the node's ID. If the web app asks, if the controller asks, does this user exist in our database? Has he been saved? Has he or she been saved? You know, again, we'll just proxy that same property from the node. And here's where we can show an example of a custom property. So the node Neo4j library, the client library, the database driver, wouldn't have any knowledge of specific properties for your domain, right? So this is an example where this is a domain-specific property. We want to track names for users. So the way you use node Neo4j for that is the node has a data dictionary. So that's the key value pairs that belong to this node. And so we'll just get and set a property by the type, you know, by the name. Real quick, I'll mention that Neo4j, I mentioned that it's schemaless. It's also pretty flexible type-wise. pretty much any type of primitive you can use in JavaScript, you can save as a node property or relationship property. The one exception is actually dates. But if you serialize that to a string or a number, then you're fine. And the reason for that is actually that Neo4j's REST API is all JSON. It's nice. There isn't even any XML. It's all JSON. So that makes it work really nicely with JavaScript. If you can JSON stringify it, you can put it into Neo4j. One caveat is that Neo4j doesn't support nested properties yet. But I know that's coming in a future version. But that hasn't generally been a problem I found in practice. Because if something's nested, that's usually a sign that you're storing joined data when that should really be a separate node. This is a simple example of a custom property where we're just saving it into the node's data dictionary. All right, so let's look at the public methods we mentioned. Let's start at user.get. So if we know a user's ID, we can just call the graph database's get node by ID function, and we get back a node. So let's just wrap that in our user class, and that's it. Listing all users, so now here's an example of using indexing with Neo4j. So in a real-world app, the things you'd most commonly index are one-to-one things, right? Like we mentioned email address for users, or usernames, or maybe like a URL to a product, things like that. But Neo4j, because Lucene, it also supports one-to-many indexing. So just for the sake of this example, what we do is we actually index all users. Yeah? Great question. You can make as many indexes as you want that are Lucene-backed. They can be different types and stuff. No, that's a great question. You don't. Yes. No, good question. Neo4j will automatically create an index if you try to index something, if that's what you're asking. Yes, good question. So Neo4j supports automatic indexing. But for this, that's a great question. In fact, in our app, we don't index anything manually. We leverage Neo4j's automatic indexing. So you can basically, in the config file for Neo4j server, you can tell it which properties it should watch. And if any properties change or a node gets saved or added with those properties, it'll automatically index that node based on those properties. Yes. And that's for performance. They've had a feature request open for a while of, like, just let me auto-index all properties. But, you know, that wouldn't be the best for this size and all that. So, yeah. But the nice thing is that's, like, a one-time config thing. In this example, actually, we're indexing stuff manually for two reasons. One is just, you know, for sake of illustration. There are a lot of cases, actually, where you might want to manually index stuff. The biggest reason is that Neo4j's automatic index is an exact index, key-value pairs. But Lucene also supports full-text indexing. So, you know, if you're actually saving some documents, things like that, or maybe you want to index users' bios or things, descriptions, things like that, you can do that. So you might want to create a second index or a third index, so on and so forth. But actually, a more practical reason is that the Heroku add-on, the Neo4j Heroku add-on, it doesn't give you access yet to the database config files. So since you can't tell it what properties to auto-index, you can't use the auto-index for this app deployed on Heroku. But you know, if you're actually using Neo4j in production or building anything serious with it, you would use auto-indexing, which is a big time saver. Okay, let's get back to this. So if you want to list all users, assuming that we've indexed them, you just tell the graph database, get me every index node for this index where the key, this is the key and this is the value. And in this case, we're using a key of type and a value of users. And that's up here. So we make one index called nodes, and we just index everything by type. And so every user we create has a type value of user, and so that's what we save. Again, this is just an impractical example. But so this gives you back all the nodes, and so we'll just, again, wrap them as user objects. So again, pretty basic, pretty simple. Creating a user. The controller will give us some data, like a dictionary with the name property. We can tell the node Neo4j driver to create a node with this data. And because we want to return our own model object, we'll, you know, again, wrap this node into model objects, and then we just call node save. And because we're manually indexing in this example, after the save happens, then we'll index that node. But again, as you can see, all this stuff is just basic boilerplate wrapper code for the built-in methods for Neo4j and, by extension, the node Neo4j driver. So let's get to some of the more interesting stuff, which is let's get my first degree connections. And this gets to your question of, you know, what if we want to do more stuff? So for this, again, there's a number of ways you could do it, right? The REST API does actually have a traversal API where you can kind of tell it, you know, give it JSON for, like, what types of relationships to follow, max depth it should go, any prune functions that it should ignore a path, things like that. But all that is procedural, and the beauty of Cypher is that it's declarative. And so for most cases, that's pretty awesome. And this is a perfect example. We have such a simple pattern to match on, which is that given one user, get me another user if they follow that user. And so here's our two start points, is our first user. And normally that would be our only start point. And that would give us the beauty of graph databases that perform a localized search. We have one start point. We're only interested in our first degree nodes. In this case, since we want every other user also, so that we can show that dropdown of who else you might want to follow, we give it another start point, which is every user. And again, we get that by the index. Right? So we say, here's my one user start point, and here's every other user that's in this index. And this question mark in Cypher next to its relationship name means that match is actually optional. So it's going to try to match, given two start points, A and B, it's going to try to match every relationship of type follows between A and B, or if there is none, it'll tell us that. So what we then return is, for every user, give me basically one or zero. Do we have a relationship or do we not have a relationship? And like SQL or any other query language, you know, for safety, you'll want to parametrize these relationships instead of doing string concatenation so that you don't get injections, for example. So the one kind of variable we have in here is user ID. So instead of putting that as string concatenation in the query, we pass it as a separate parameter. But otherwise, it's pretty simple. You just do db.query, you give it the query string, and you give it the parameters to inject, and then you get back results. So I thought this is a good example to actually show live. So let's do some live queries. All right. So all right. So let's start at one user. And just for the sake of going one by one. Oops, sorry. Neo4j doesn't know about anything called user. They're called nodes. If we just start at a point and don't do any kind of traversing, just return it, we get back zone. Can you guys see this actually? I'll bump it up. Is that what people were going to raise their hands for? Actually, this is a good case. The Neo4j team built this great web console, which is pretty nifty. It's hosted on Heroku and whatnot, but the idea is pretty cool. It's like whenever you want to just test a simple query, you go to this page, and on the fly, they spin up a new Neo4j database. It's in memory, so it's also fast. And in this case, it's pre-populated with some matrix data, so we could actually clear everything. So we'll say start n equals node star. That matches every node. Delete n. And unable to, we have to delete relationships also, sorry. So for safety, Neo4j doesn't let you delete nodes unless all of the relationships have also been deleted. So we'll just specify that here. Okay. So now, another cool thing is, this is all shareable and stuff, so we can even give it like initial state and initial query and all that stuff. And you click the generate, and then you can share this link with someone, and they go to it, and cool. So this graph has no data except the root node. All right. So let's start actually doing some queries. So first, we might want to populate the graph with something, right? Obviously, this isn't something you do in a typical web app, but you could imagine that for testing purposes, you want to create something, or just in the case like this. So Neo4j has a nice, Cypher has a nice create command. So let's say we make three users, right? We'll call them A, B, and can you guess? C. All right, so we have three users, A, B, and C. And the nice thing is, in this case, actually, this shows an example of auto-indexing. For these databases, they have auto-indexes configured for the name property. So now let's say we want to have the node. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Just yell out, guys, if you can't see the stuff. My bad. All right. So let's say we start. So first, let's just get a user, right? So this is how we give it a start point. In this case, we're not doing a traversing. We'll just return that user directly. And so I'm sure, as you guys can guess, this says start at a node. You can also start relationships if you want. And then how do we get this node? We get it from the index, which is the auto index is called node auto index. So you don't have to create it. You don't have to index anything manually. And you give it the key value paired match. And this is fully backed by Lucene. So you know you can use the full Lucene syntax. You could do Boolean queries like ors and ands. You could do substrings, things like that. All right, but now let's have a follow people. So here, let's give it another, let's give it the other users, B and C. And so just again, to sanity check on the way, if I return all three, I have all three. Great. So now let's have them follow each other. So we might say, and again, this is just ASCII art, which is pretty cool. So we might say have A follow B, B follow A back maybe, and then let's have C follow B. So when I execute this, now you can see this visualization on the side, which is neat. A is following B, B is following A back, and C is following B. We have this root node hanging out. Don't worry about that reference node. Don't worry about that guy. All right, so now how do we query this? So let's say we want to start at A. I'll just leave the other stop points. They don't matter if we're not going to use them. But let's get the people that A follows. So we're going to specify something like this. We're going to say match this pattern where A follows. I'm just realizing, can all of you see even at the bottom? Or is it a little too low for some of you guys? Let me see what I can do. Let's do this. Let's resize this guy. And I'll bring it back down when you want to see the visualization. It would be nice if there was an option to have this text box at the top. But all right, so we're giving it basically an ASCII art pattern to match, right? We're saying match one node called A, pointing to another node called other, where the relationship type is follows. And so the way it you know executes this is it sees A is the same name that a start point was given. So it's going to start there. There's no start point called other, so that's something that's unbound. That's what it's going to find. And then if we return the others, then we should get back just one. We should get back just one result, the B node, right? But now let's try the other way around. Let's see who follows B. So we'll just flip the direction of the arrow. And now we should get back both A and C, right? And just in case you guys couldn't see it, this was the change to the query. We just changed A to B, and we flipped that arrow. And so it's pretty straightforward from there, right? If you wanted to fetch second-degree connections, let's do that. Let's say I'm C. I want to see my second-degree connections. So let me get my first-degree connections, right? And then let me get their first-degree connections, which are my second. And so now let's return first and second. So for each match, so you know there's one match here. I only have one second-degree connection whose first-degree connection is first. And you know if each second-degree connection had multiple first-degree connections, I could collect them all together. And it's through this query that we get back at one of the screenshots I showed right in the beginning where we can show exactly which of your first-degree connections follows your second degrees. Yeah. Yeah, good question. You can. I could simplify this to say times two. The only reason to break it out is if you're interested in that intermediate node. Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, Cypher is actually very very powerful, very expressive. Yeah. Good question. Yes, you can. So if you wanted to say that follows me back. Secondary connections follow. Yes. So the nice thing is you can give multiple patterns to match and just comma separate them, and it's really nice. It's really like if you guys remember, you know, back from computer science classes, SAT is an unsolved problem. This is kind of approaching that. It feels like from users, so that's kind of cool. But yeah, so, you know, Cypher is really expressive. There's much more that you can do, but I just thought as a basic start. Hopefully that explains a bit. So if we go back to this query, this is basically what we ran, right? We just said start at every user out there and then tell me whether I follow them or not. So we run that and we get back everyone. And so we just say, we just basically, to the controller, we just return two arrays, following and others. And the way we break that out is we just iterate through each result. And if this count of relationships is zero, we put them in the not following an array. And if the count is one, we put them in the following array. I don't know if that totally makes sense. So I'll just, to clarify, I'll go back to the show function where we're using it. So we're saying, if you want to show a user, let's say you want to show my user, first get my user, and then get basically this following and others. So here's the array of users that I follow. Here's the array of all other users. And so that's how we break them out in the view as here are the users I follow, and here are the users I don't follow. So yeah, that's an example of a Sci-Fi query. You know, editing is also just basic. You're just changing the property and, sorry, I should say you're just changing the property and then calling save. So this is a super simplistic example, but hopefully it shows, you know, using Node Near4j in a web app. Yeah. Yes, great question. That's a fantastic question. Yes, Neo4j supports streaming results. So that's one answer. You can pass it a special header, and then it'll return the results of the stream. So if you guys have used any streaming API like Twitter's or Facebook, the idea is that it's not RESTful in the sense that your status code no longer reflects success or error. Your status code from HTTP is always going to be 200. And it's just going to stream line by line as it iterates. So if it encounters an error, you know, you have to be able to parse that. The whole thing won't necessarily be a valid JSON document, stuff like that. So yeah, you can do that. For paginating large result sets, Cypher does have typical SQL type operators like order by and skip and limit. So you can use that. But as we'll get to, in fact, very soon now, is when you think about kind of scaling your database up, like how do you actually attack these kinds of problems? So, yeah. Great question. I'm going to answer your question through the presentation. So let me get back to that now, actually. And I realized that, you know, you guys were seeing Times New Roman for all my font, which is a bummer because that's not the actual font. So that's because I loaded this offline. Actually, it should be presentation mode. All right. Cool. So that's the library. If you guys have any feedback or pull requests, feedback, issues, comments, that's all welcome. The README has all information on that. We have Google Groups, so give it a try. We'd love to see what you guys built with it. All right, so real quick, I'll just mention some more Neo4j specific things. It comes in three flavors, Community, Advanced, Enterprise, and as this illustrates, I really think there's two flavors. I can't imagine a single use case for Advanced, but I might not just have run into that yet. But basically, there's a... all three of these are open source, and all three of them are free as in beer to check out the source and all that stuff. But Community is the only one that's GPL, which for a database means you're free to use it for anything you want, whereas the Enterprise and Advanced Editions, they're AGPL, which means you can only use it for free if your actual web app is also open source. So Enterprise and Advanced you have to pay for, but the nice thing is you get nice support with it. We're using Enterprise 53. We love it, and their support team has been super helpful. Neo4j, just in general, the company is a super helpful company. They do a lot to help and whatnot. But the big difference from the editions is that the Community Edition is meant for simpler apps. You can only have one instance, on one box. And if you ever want to take a backup of that data, you have to stop the database, take a backup, and start it up again. So for any real production app, you'll want to use Enterprise, which lets you do a high availability cluster. And we'll talk about that in a sec, but it also lets you do online backups. So you can, it's log-based. You can keep taking an incremental backup as your database is running. So for scaling the database, whereas you think of key-value stores as being highly partitionable, And on the other hand, you have something like a relational database, which isn't trivial partitional. Graphs are closer to that. Graph databases are closer to the relational database side, right? Because if you have a graph like Facebook's social graph, you can't trivially partition that because the whole definition of a graph is you have interconnected data. So the way you scale a graph database is through master-slave replication. Just like a relational database, the idea is that you put all your writes through one machine, called a master, so that everything's consistent. Simplified view, but right? And if you are okay with eventual consistency, you do your reading from the slaves. And in most, at least consumer-facing web apps, the ratio of reads to writes is, orders of magnitude different. That tends to work perfectly fine. But if you still are finding issues scaling, Neo4j has a pretty nice in-memory cache built in of the whole graph. So, whatever you're reading from disk, it'll cache that in memory, and it keeps everything consistent, which is nice. But if you're having trouble scaling, the first step they'll always mention is memory. Make sure you have enough memory that you can fit the whole graph into memory. That way, disk activity will be low. But if you can't do that, then the way you can scale your instances is by kind of sharding what parts of the graph you hit each instance with. That way, each instance is more likely to have that part of the graph in its memory cache. That's a pretty advanced thing. I mean, we haven't even gotten there, and I don't see ourselves getting there anytime soon, because if you're really having trouble scaling, maybe a better approach is to actually use different databases for different types of data. So, a lot of places use a polyglot approach. Like, you might want to use a relational database for number crunching things. You might want to use disconnected data you might want to use a key value store for disconnected data. If you're Twitter, for example, and you want like raw performance, you might put your timelines in an extremely high performance key value store, but still use a graph database for the social graph for other things, so on and so forth. It's also worth mentioning the limits of scale, just the raw number limits of scale for Neo4j specifically. There are some limits, but the good thing is that all these limits are you could call them soft limits. They're like a build time config. And so I'll give you a perfect example. Today, there's a 64 billion limit on the number of nodes a single Neo4j instance can hold. And actually, this number has been increasing maybe like every half year. I think when we started, it was just 4 billion, and they've kept on increasing it. And the reason for this limit is actually pretty simple. Early on, we mentioned fixed size records on disk, right, for very fast performance. So that means each ID has to fit a certain number of bytes on disk. And so you take that number of bytes, and that's how you get your limit. So the cool thing is that's trivially increasable. And the Neo4j team has shared that, if you're a high-scale app that needs more nodes relationships, they can just give you a build that has that uses larger ID space. It's worth mentioning that this 64 billion limit is probably not what you'll actually run into, because this is actually also the limit for properties. So if each node relationship has a certain number of properties, it's lower. We found that with Thingdom, our average property count per node was around 20. And that was actually a lot of properties. We were actually duplicating some properties for indexing in a customized kind of way. But if you round up, say, 100, that's 640 million nodes. That's just Facebook just crossed that user mark not too long ago. So hopefully you'll be fine. All right. So from here on out, I'll be kind of sharing a bunch of specific lessons we learned, both building for graph databases generally and Neo4j in particular. All right. So let's start. So if we go back to this whiteboard example of users following each other and having and wanting products and leaving comments on products, things like that, you can see what's the salient information. Well, it's right here in the diagram. It's the relationship types. It's follows and wants and comments, stuff like that, right? Then if we think back to the file format or how Neo4j actually stores the stuff on disk, it's all these linked lists, right? So from a node, you have a linked list of all the node's relationships. It's an adjacency list, right? So now think, when Neo4j is doing a query, how is it actually translating that to disk lookups? Well, it starts at a node, it looks at all the relationships and figures out which relationships do I need to traverse. What that means is, for that relationship, visit the node it points to and repeat. And so the only thing that it has about the relationships, the only information it knows at that level is the relationship type. Right? We mentioned in a property graph, that's the one required piece of knowledge that the graph database needs to know, is what is the type of that relationship. And it's for that reason, so it knows how to traverse. So you can save, you know, you can make your queries faster, and you can save yourself, you know, headaches if you use very expressive and unique relationship types. So that's kind of the first lesson learned. This will go a long way for you, both in your queries and for your domain modeling. So one rule of thumb we actually had was, we wanted to say that given any relationship type, we should know what types of nodes in our domain are on each end. So a perfect example of this is we actually started with a relationship type called follows. And it made total sense, like Twitter, you know, user X follows user Y. At some point, we were thinking, you know, we had a notion of categories, and we thought it might be nice to be able to follow categories also. Like if you're interested in photography, follow that photography category so that as interesting things happen in the world of photography, you can, you know, be notified. But we made a good call that if we did that, we shouldn't reuse the name follows for that relationship type. We should do something unique like follows underscore category. Even something simple like that, right? It's the relationship type is a string value. Yeah. Yes. Yep. So you know, use unique expressive relationship types, that'll go a long way. I mentioned early on, actually, you know, perfect example, we were coding and we listed all users, so we fetched every user from the index and we said upfront that will not scale, that's not something you should actually do in a real app. So similarly, what won't scale is that every time you want to show information, have a certain piece of information, having to follow everyone's graph. So here's an example of the latter. We wanted to maintain, you know, like a leaderboard, you could say, of the most products each person had, right? Or each person had shared, or whatever you want to call it. So two things. One is, every time we show this page, do we have to look up every single user and calculate this on the fly, even if it's in the database, right? I mean, as this grows, that's one question. The next question is, when we want to show these stats. So anytime we showed a user, just like Twitter shows the number of followers and following, we want to show the number of followers and the number of products. So every time we show a user, do we have to visit their whole local graph? The answers to those both should be no, right? So this is a case where you want to really cache things for performance. Sounds obvious, but it's worth saying that graph databases are not necessarily a magic bullet for this sort of stuff, right? So in this case, for example, really cache properties, yeah. Good question. Yeah, if you use the Java APIs, they do. That stuff isn't translated yet into the REST API. But actually, that's kind of a general theme, too, is that the using Neo4j from non-Java APIs is still evolving. But actually, they're getting a lot better. And in particular, Cypher is evolving, and it's become their recommended way of using Neo4j now. So a lot of stuff is coming to that, which is nice. So real quick, in this example, what this meant was we literally had properties on our user nodes that had these counts on them. And then whenever that person followed or unfollowed someone, we'd update that stat, which is easy to do, 01. But that let reading those numbers also be 01 instead of ON. And then same thing globally, which is that you could and should cache these global leaderboard kind of things somewhere instead of having to fetch everyone in an index each time. Okay, here's another cool example. So if we go back to this diagram, sorry, I'm just changing slides so frequently. This graph reflects the state of the world at some moment in time, right? This user named Alice has an iPhone. This user named Bob wants an iPhone. That will likely change at some point in the future. Alice might lose her iPhone, might sell it. Bob might get one. He might become an Android convert and no longer want an iPhone. You know, things like that. So with any database, you have a choice of how you track history, if at all. And you know, if you're even interested in it, but if you do, how you differentiate that from the current state of the world. So I thought it was worth sharing a pattern that we came up with that we came to like quite a bit, which was we chose to say that the relationships in the graph represent the state of the world at any given point in time, and if we want to capture history, we'll do that through nodes. And specifically, we call those nodes events. And that was kind of inspired by both Facebook, but also GitHub's API has a very similar notion of like commit events and push events, things like that, right? So here's what this diagram shows. We have time going up. And so these nodes in the middle correspond to the event nodes. And so this first node at the bottom is a want event. This happens the moment Alice clicked want on the iPhone 4. So we captured that this user wants this thing, right? And then some point later in time, she bought an iPhone 4, let's say, and she changed, you know, on the website, just like on Twitter, you can say follow or unfollow. You know, on our website, we let you say want or have and switch. You can switch back and forth or unhave, unwant, stuff like that. So when she changed it from want to has, we saved another node that captured that change. Again, pointed to the same user and same thing. Then at some point in the future, the iPhone 4S was announced, and so she clicked want there, so then we captured that new event, and so on and so forth. She bought that. Then she sold her old iPhone, and then turned out she lost the iPhone 4S, and so she left the description on that event node. So that was really nice because this was a building block then for feeds. Then we were able to show feeds for both users and things, which became actually probably the most interesting part of our domain. So you could actually generalize this notion into something you asked, or this gets at something you asked earlier between nodes and relationships. So let me generalize that and then get back to your question. So we also had this notion for following. Just like on Facebook, you get in your newsfeed, you can see stories when a friend follows someone else. Similarly, on Twitter, at some point they add it in your interactions tab or connections tab, you get, you know, you see stories when people follow you or retweet your things or favorite your things, stuff like that. So similarly, we added a following event. So we captured whenever someone followed someone else. And as you know, just like Facebook doesn't have an unlike story, unlike event, we didn't capture the unfollows. We just deleted the following story if it was recent enough, things like that. But so we had a similar notion of following. But the cool thing is that this showed us what kind of stuff we could do. And one example of that was, at some point, we had this neat feature request. This one user of ours, she was really excited by the site. She was using it a bunch. She added a bunch of stuff. And then she said, you know, I invited my brother to the site. He hasn't joined yet, but I know half the things that he wants and has, and I'd like to just, like, fill out his profile for him. So we made a notion of suggestions. So we said, Alice can suggest something for Bob. This would notify Bob saying, Alice thinks you have or want an iPhone. And then, you know, you could click in that email, I have it or I want it or whatever, right? And so this was a good example of, whereas before, have and want relationships, they connect just two nodes, so the have and want events also connect two nodes. This is an example of connecting three nodes. And that's something actually that a relationship can't do in a general graph database. Relationships can't connect more than two nodes. In theory, in computer science theory, you could say they can, and those are called hyper edges. But ultimately, you know, if you're implementing a graph database using the primitives of node and edge, a hyper edge is actually implemented as a node that connects two or more nodes. So this was an example of that. So a suggestion connects three nodes. That's something you can't do with a relationship. So that kind of opened our eyes to something. We thought there might be something there. And so that led us to the generalization that there is this notion of first-classness in the graph. And this is the start of that. So nodes can connect more than two nodes. Relationships can't. But it goes the other way, too. So if Alice has an iPhone, what's interesting in this diagram earlier, the first diagram I showed, is we showed an example of a comment, right? We showed Bob as the author of this comment asking thoughts on this iPhone, and then some other user, you know, replies, I heart it. But the thing is, Bob isn't able to comment on specifically Alice having the iPhone. He can't comment on their relationship because relationships can't be the target of other relationships. This is, again, similar to hyperedges. I mean, you could say in graph theory maybe they should be able to, but ultimately if you're implementing a graph database using primitives with nodes and edges, that's just not the case. And so that was kind of an eye-opening revelation for us, which is that if you want to be able to do first-class operations on things, those things need to be nodes. So whether you want to connect multiple nodes, whether you want to let people comment on them, whether you want to let people like them, you know, bookmark them, whatever it is, those first-class operations deserve to be nodes. Here was a great example of this. This was a big mistake we made early on and that we were never able to, like, fully recover from. I mean, we could have, but it would just been an investment. It would have been a forklift effort. So our very first, like, MVP implementation of the site was actually extremely basic. It was what you saw in this first diagram minus the comments. So it was literally just, like, users. Actually, we didn't even have users following other users. We literally just had you could have things and want things, and your page would show that. So that was our MVP. And early on, we realized that as people started adding their stuff, like, we needed some kind of organization. And so we thought a good start for that would be just automatic categorization, much like Amazon has different departments. We thought we should be able to automatically derive that info. So we did, and that was a good start. And so we had, like, an electronics category. We had, like, a sports category, like a books category, you know, stuff like that. But for prototyping purposes, we thought, you know, indexing is actually really convenient for this. So we added just a property on our nodes called category. And we gave it a value of, give it a value of books or movies or whatever, right? And then that way, on the product page, we could show the category really easily. And then if you click on that link, we could just do a very simple index lookup and show the thing. Obviously, you know, scaling, I mentioned, is an issue, so you'd have to paginate that. Not efficient. But aside from that, the biggest problem was this totally defeats the purpose of a graph database, is that now you've fragmented all that information. So a really simple example is we initially named that category movies. And then we realized actually people also have DVDs or Blu-rays of, like, TV shows. So should we actually call it, like, movie/TV. Well, doing that now meant having to update every node in that category, update that property, right? So rename is a pain. But again, we go back to first classness. So if people wanted to follow a category, if people wanted to leave comments on a category, like, if I'm interested in running, I don't know which running shoes to get, I want to be able to go to the running page and leave a comment, not tied to any particular thing. I can't do that if running is a property on each node as opposed to its own node. So again, like, you know, look for that, like, this is the equivalent of, like, a graph database smell, as if you're duplicating data anywhere, it should, you know, consider that it might be better off being a node. So just like first class means it should be a node, connectedness also means it should be a node. So this diagram showed what we should have done is have different nodes for these things, and that would have also then led us to even cooler things like have hierarchies. Yeah. Normalize everything. Yep, because that's how you get the strength of graph database. And so that's actually, by the way, that's been one of the nicest parts of using a graph database, is that until you really need to explicitly for performance reasons, you don't have to denormalize left and right. Your data is kind of your canonical data, and you can still query with and work with it pretty easily. And so real quick, this diagram also shows another cool thing, which is besides the hierarchies, like, you know, all these guys are iPhones. iPhones are cell phones are electronics. We can also have orthogonal subgraphs, like brands. So iPhones are actually part of the, is it considered a category? I don't know. Is it a brand? Maybe. It's, you know, Apple. Or, like, you know, Microsoft, and Apple, and Sony, and things like that, right? So that's nice. Graphs, again, let you do, you know, using nodes and relationships let you do crossing data, whatever that term is, better than properties would. Okay, now we get the most interesting lesson we learned, and this was, again, one of the most useful things we'd wished we'd known in the beginning. That was, it was a scaling lesson learned, but this gets at some, I think, something you had asked earlier about cursors and pagination. So at some point, we added feeds. So since we had all these event nodes now, right, like person X following person Y, or having an iPhone, wanting an iPhone, losing their iPhone, whatever, commenting on stuff. These are all nodes now, so we could show them as a feed. So we initially did the equivalent of the kind of Cypher query you guys saw earlier with friends, where we said, if I want to show my feed, like you go to my user's page, perform a query that starts at my user node and gets all of the relationships of type like follow event source, comment author, what else would it be? Like have event user, want event user, you know, things like that. And then, so we have all these nodes now, and then we'd use the equivalent of like an order by skip limit to order by time, return the first 20, or if you go to page 2, return the second 20, things like that. And you know, to be fair, that actually was very easy to do. We implemented it very quickly. It worked, and it held up pretty nicely for quite a while, and it was nice. But obviously, you can imagine that as a user state, it grows and grows and grows. When we think back to Neo4j's file format, its storage on disk, it's not optimized for that kind of query, right? This data is not stored as a B-tree balanced by timestamp. It's not stored in any other particular data structure that would let it maintain this list very efficiently. So it would have to visit every node before sorting and pruning that stuff in memory. So what we realized, and a lot of credit here goes to this this fellow named Rene Picard is his last name. He's over in Europe. He's a PhD student doing a lot of graph theory work, but he came up with this technique and some more like it, which is pretty nice. It's the notion of kind of storing this list as a linked list, which is a perfect example of a graph, so you can store that in a graph database perfectly. So you can say, given Alice's user node, store the head relationship to her most recent event. And from that, store the next relationship, and the next relationship, and the next relationship. And so now, when you want to fetch her first 20 things, again, it's now an O1 lookup. It has to fetch 20 relationships, and it would be that Cypher query that we showed in the beginning, you know, relationship type star 20. In this case, you could do star 0 dot dot 20, which would match if she had less than 20 things. And that way, you get the first 20 things very efficiently. And the cool thing is now you have a cursor. If you want to go to page 2, you know that last node's ID. So when you want to fetch page 2, instead of starting at Alice, you'll start at that last node and fetch the next 20. Yeah, I mean, that is a good way of looking at it. It is denormalizing in some sense. Because it's in the sense that, like, you know, if you want to delete, let's say, this middle node, you'll have to rewire these two relationships also. So you do have a little bit of redundancy. But the cool thing is it's all O1 still, right? We all know that rewiring a linked list is O1, whether it's inserting or removing something. Yes. In fact, a lot of people call this an in-graph index. Yeah, so it's using the graph database for what it's good at, which is connectedness. And in this case, linked lists are all about connectedness. So this is a kind of subtle thing that you might not actually need to use unless you actually do want to return a list, you know, a sublist of something that's going to grow and grow and grow. But it's something that, you know, we found useful. And we wished we had done from the start. It's not actually a hard thing to wire up in retrospect, but it's cool if you think about it from the start. So what Rene actually did was he took this approach and applied it to the aggregate too. So this is an example of if you want to show Alice's feed. But now what if you're viewing the site and you follow Alice and you want to share your home feed? So like the equivalent of Facebook's homepage or Twitter's homepage, where it's not your events, it's the events of everyone that you follow. But those should all be merge sorted, right? So for most cases, let's use that as an example. So the way we did it initially to build off of what we initially did was on my home feed, the query would look like start at my node, fetch all my first degree connections, users, and then fetch all of their feeds. Now we have all these second-degree nodes, and then, you know, order them by something, and again, skip and limit. So now it has to, again, right, Neo4j has to get all these second-degree nodes in memory and sort them and limit them. But at least now if you have these lists per user, now what I can do is if I want the 20 most recent things, I can just fetch for each user I follow their first 20 feed items and merge sort those. So that's still not perfect because I'm potentially doing 20 times the number of people I follow worth of work. But in most social networks, you know, the number of people that someone follows is usually on the order of like 50 or 100. It's not millions. Even like the Lady Gaga problem, if you're Twitter, Lady Gaga has a million followers, but she's not following a million people. So that, you know, that turns out to be a pretty reasonable win. What Renee did was something that Twitter might actually do, which is that you could actually also maintain a list of each user's home feed. The cost that has is that if you're Lady Gaga and you tweet something, you now have to add this tweet node to a million lists, whereas with this simpler, just each user's profile feed, you just have to add it to one list. That's pretty subtle. You can ask me afterwards if that didn't quite make sense. But anyway, this was the last kind of lesson we learned that was really pretty useful. So that's just to summarize the kind of lessons learned. Unique relationship types, because with any graph database, that's kind of the building block of your queries. So don't be afraid to be expressive there. Cache stuff wherever possible, right? So whether it's global things or in this case, even local things, cache properties. And a theme for all this stuff is like if it's first-class data in your domain, really consider making it a node because that gives you the expressiveness to connect things and connect both other nodes and relationships to that thing. So one specific pattern for that we came up with, which we've really liked, is let the relationships in the graph represent the state of the world today and capture history in the past through event nodes. I should mention an advantage to that also is that if the relationships always represent the state today, that'll let your queries be faster, right? Because the number of relationships in your graph isn't exploding. So when you're doing queries, you have fewer relationships to consider. Again, on the notion of first class, if you see duplicate data anywhere, consider that it should actually be a single node so that it can be connected. And then an example, example of that we mentioned was categories and tags. But the last thing is kind of again going on the notion of caching is that if you find yourself doing big aggregation queries and using order by and limit and skip, consider just caching that stuff in graph as what's called an in-graph index, or you're just using linked lists in general for that. All right, so real quick, I'll just wrap up by sharing kind of what Neo4j is that I'm aware of that Neo4j is working on right now. So one is they want to make indexing even better. They've learned that auto-indexing is what everyone loves and uses, so they want to make that even better. They want to let you have multiple auto-indexes that have different configurations, and that should just be the default for everything. And they want to put that into Cypher even more, so you'll be able to add and remove things to manual indexes from Cypher, but you'll also be able to say that for this type of node, so they're introducing a notion of labels, so just like relationships have types. They're realizing that every practical way that people use graph, Neo4j, nodes also have domain-specific types. So they're letting a notion of that be captured first class so that they can make indexing even easier. So you can say, if this is a type user, these are the properties to auto-index. If this is a type photo, these are the properties to auto-index, and so on and so forth. One thing I didn't cover here was something called the supernode problem. I should remember to add that for next time. But if you go back to the Neo4j file format, all right, so we saw that each relationship has a, don't worry about this diagram, right? It's hard to make sense, but if I have a 1,000 relationships, my node on disk only points to the first relationship, and that first relationship points to the second relationship, second points to the third, so it's a linked list 1,000 long, right? So now every time Neo4j is doing a query, it has to traverse that list of 1,000, which actually in most cases is not a problem. It becomes a problem when you're Lady Gaga and you have a million followers, because this means you have a million relationships of type follows in, but if you only have one person you follow, it's still going to cost you a million lookups before you get to that one relationship. And so this is called the supernode problem. So you can, ironically, we mentioned early on that a graph database was this notion of local indexes, right? Like for each node, here are my relationships. So the problem is if this local index becomes a million long and you suffer performance getting one relationship out of there, ironically, what you can do is globally index that one relationship. So because at least a global index is, it's still either a hash table or a B-tree, so that's still going to be faster than looking through a million long linked list. But so there's a workaround possible today, but this has been on the Neo4j roadmap for a while, and they're actively pursuing it now, which is they're going to change the file format on disk so that each node's list of relationships will become probably a B-tree or a dictionary based on the relationship type. So now if you're Lady Gaga and you have a million followers, that won't affect the performance of fetching your one person that you do follow. I don't know exactly when that'll come, but something to think about. Another thing they're actively working on is making the server even better and faster. So right now, the only way to communicate to a server is through HTTP, which has a lot of overhead. So besides investigating like Speedy, they're also actively investing in building a binary protocol, just like something like MySQL has, so that you'd be able to keep a single connection open and just do all your queries, pipeline and all that stuff through that very, very fast. And I think some raw performance numbers they've seen out of some early testing is just like two or three orders of magnitude faster than over HTTP, which is pretty cool. But the last thing is, I mentioned that like something like Facebook Social Graph is not trivially partitionable, but they're tackling that problem, which is cool. They're going to see if they can figure out if they can implement first class in Neo4j an algorithm to automatically detect clusters and transparently shard that data across different Neo4j instances, but without the app having to know. So the app still, just talks to the cluster, asks for this data or that data, and it'll automatically balance that stuff out. That seems like magic to me. I don't know how you do that, but they've been working on it for a year now, so hopefully soon, which is pretty exciting. So as a wrap up, again, I'm 53. I wish I could share what we're building, hopefully soon. But yeah, if you haven't checked out what we're doing, definitely check it out, 53.com. We're in the App Store. Our app is called Paper. But come up to me afterwards if you have any questions. Otherwise, thank you. Hopefully that was useful. Thanks, guys.